Good morning, everybody. Nice to be back here again. This time in the sunny Bay of Plenty. Last time I remember that we had to fight through the deluge to get here. Brother John said I thought an appropriate title to the exhortation might be careful how you play with fire. And obviously, our reading in Numbers chapter 16 is the basis of exhortation with a title like that. It was a very difficult time for the nation of Israel. And I guess you have to go back to Numbers chapter 14, to the tragic events of what happened when Moses sent out the 12 spies, and 10 of them came back with their evil report that although the land be very good, there are giants in the land and we are not able to overcome. And on the basis of the faithlessness of the majority vote, 10 verses 2, God brought a punishment upon the nation of Israel that none of that generation should enter into his rest, save Joshua and Caleb. And as I discussed with Dad the other day, perhaps some of the Levites. But you can imagine if you were amongst that generation. Here you were taken out of Egypt and you've been travelling in the wilderness, and now your focus is upon trying to get to this land flowing with milk and honey, and you've had all of these trials that you've gone through. You know, you've been hungry and then God's provided you food. You've been thirsty and God's provided you with water. And you've had all these difficult trials and walking through the wilderness, and now you've seen the land. And you're right there on the verge of the land, and the reports come back and say, yes, it's a fantastic place. But then, of course, faithlessness brought about this disbelief in their ability to overcome. And now comes the judgment that this whole generation is not going to receive the land. And they are very downhearted. And at the end of chapter 14, after these events, they suddenly had a change of mind. In verse 40, they get up early in the morning and got to the top of the mountain saying, lo, we be here, now we'll go into the place that the Lord has promised, for we have sinned. It's all a bit late now. Moses said to them, why do you transgress the commandment of the Lord? You shall not go up and prosper. Don't go up, because the Lord is not with you. Nevertheless, in verse 44 it says, they presumed to go up to the top of the hill without the Ark of the Covenant, and the Lord and Moses departed not from the camp. And in verse 45, then came the Amalekites down from the mountain, and the Canaanites which dwelt in the hill, and smote them and discomfited them even to Hormah. So you had this attempt. They couldn't even get past the first obstacle to get into the land. They couldn't get past the Amalekites and the Canaanites who came down and whipped them and left them running back with their tails between their legs. So what happens then? It's the natural reaction. The blame game, isn't it? It's always what happens. It's the blame game. It's all gone pear-shaped. Everything's turned to custard. They've come out of Egypt and it's not going to happen. They're going to die in the wilderness. Whose fault is it? Well, then began the murmuring amongst the people. And by the time you get to chapter 16, it's Moses' fault. It's Aaron's fault. That's what it is. They brought us out here. We're not going to get into the land that we were promised. They promised us this land. And so you get this delegation in chapter 16 that come to blame Moses and Aaron for everything that goes wrong. You know, we can do that in life. I know I do that. I was just recently on a bit of an excursion with my two sons doing a bit of maintenance work, and they helped me. And whenever something went a little bit pear-shaped during the maintenance, I was always quick to look and see which one of them was to blame for why things didn't quite go the way they should. And it's a natural reaction when things go wrong to look at somebody else and to put the blame off. And it's actually venting your frustration. It's diverting your anger onto somebody else. And you see, the problem with blame is you're never dealing with the issue. By passing the responsibility onto somebody else or passing the blame to somebody else, you've never dealt with it yourself. And it becomes internalized within yourself. And the only real way to deal with things that go wrong is to really look inwardly. Kath and I were just with Brother TJ and they're building a house and they're having lots of frustration with subcontractors, and one of their biggest frustrations they have with subcontractors is the blame game. And that they're dealing with these subcontractors and something goes wrong and the subcontractor's blaming, you know, well, it's the sparkies that held us up. It's you know, the person doing the carpet. It was the guy doing the kitchen. It's the guy doing the sound. It's his fault. He's held up the whole works. And all these contractors, whatever happens, they're always looking for somebody else to assign the blame to. And TJ said, you know, a couple of the contractors are straight up. And he said, they're like a breath of fresh air. Something goes wrong and they turn around and say, oh, look, I messed up here. I should have ordered it, I didn't order it, I'm really sorry, I forgot. And TJ said that for them was fantastic. They would rather hear that than all the other stuff that's going around, which they know is just diverting the real issue. And I guess we can be like that. Well, Cora Dacom and Abiram were very much like that. And it seems that they... You know, when you want to try to blame somebody else and you want to assign it, what you do is you try to get as many people behind you, don't you? That's what Cora Dacom, you know, you get a delegation behind you. And they've got it worked out because Dacom and Abiram, you see, they're from Reuben. He's the firstborn, isn't he, of Jacob's children. So the firstborn had certain rights. So Dacom and Abiram, they have rights and responsibilities as the eldest. They have in their favour that they are the firstborn of the children of Jacob. But of course they don't have the priesthood with them, so they need somebody else. So Korah, of course, he's cousin to Aaron and Moses. He's of the Levites. So they get Korah on their side and he's their spokesman. So now they've got the firstborn right of Reuben and they have the priesthood. They've got a rock solid appointment. And they actually have done their homework. They go around and they gather together their little group of support in amongst the children of Israel to attack Moses. And herein is what their case against Moses is. Verse 3, they gather themselves against Moses and Aaron and says, you take too much upon yourselves, seeing all the congregation holy, and the Lord is among them. Wherefore do you lift yourself up above the congregation? It's interesting, isn't it? You know, like when you go back into the history, Moses didn't want that job. Because the last thing he wanted was to have that job. He looked for any way to avoid this responsibility that God was going to make him a shepherd of his people. Same thing with Jesus, wasn't it? They, after he fed the 5,000, they would take him by force and make him king. And he chose not to be king. My kingdom is not of this world. But when he was charged before Pilate, this man maketh himself a king. He didn't make himself a king. Neither did Moses and Aaron. They didn't want this responsibility, but in the eyes of the people, or Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, They were elevating themselves and lifting themselves up. They were looking for power. Well, it was Korah, Dathan, and Abiram that were seeking the power, wasn't it? That was what this was all about. And the question is, who is holy before God? Who is separate before God? Who has God chosen? And then is going to become the real test to who is holy. Now the interesting thing, I want you to see Moses' response in verse 4 to this challenge. I find this unbelievable. You know, this tells you everything about Moses, because when you're challenged by somebody else, when somebody points the finger at you and says, you're only doing this for your own sake, you're only doing this for your own glory and your own power, what is the natural reaction? You stand tall, you puff out your chest, and you say, what gives you the right? Who are you to say these things to me? That's what your natural reaction would be. That's what my reaction would be. Who are these people? Who do they think they are? And you would stand tall to defend yourself. Moses' reaction, look at him. When Moses heard this, he fell to the ground. He just fell to the ground before them. This is a man of true humility. And whilst he's prostrate on the ground, I believe the answer comes to him from God. Because in the moment, what Moses does is he prays. Why did he fall to the ground? He seeks God's help on this immediately. He falls to the ground, and then by the time he raises from the earth, he has the answer. God's answer comes to him. In verse 5, he spoke to Korah and said, tomorrow, now that's interesting as well. God didn't do this straight away. He gives these guys time to think about this. Think very carefully about this decision. Not immediately. Don't run off right now and do this. But this time tomorrow, I'm going to give you 24 hours to consider this decision you're making. This time, even tomorrow, the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will cause him to come near to him. Even those whom he has chosen will he cause to come near. Now go and do this. Go and get every man who's sent up and bring them before the Lord tomorrow. You know, this was the litmus test. This was the test that God was going to use to see who's holy. He didn't say to them, righto, go and put your best clothes on and let's see who's wearing the best clothes or dressed the best, and that will decide who's holy. Go and choose what translation of the Bible you read and let's see who's holy. Is it the Authorized, the NIV, the RSV? Which one's going to discern? Go and choose what worship song you're going to sing before the Lord and let's discern who's holy. Now the litmus test that is used for what is holy and what is not is incense. Go. Now that's a scary thing, isn't it? You know, because all of them would have remembered an event. Come back for a moment to Leviticus chapter 10. Be careful when you play with fire. Everybody in the nation would have remembered this event. Leviticus 10 verse 1. And Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took either of them his censer and put fire therein and put incense thereon and offered strange fire to the Lord, which he commanded them not. And there went out fire from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. And Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord spake, I will be sanctified in them that come nigh before me, and before all the people I'll be glorified. And Aaron held his peace. Can you just for a moment imagine that? This is Aaron's children. Aaron's own children, his flesh and blood, have gone and offered to God strange fire, strange incense, and fires come down from heaven, and whoosh. And Moses has to turn to Aaron and Aaron, this is what God said. He said he'd be sanctified and those that come near to him in the way that he said. And Aaron held his peace. But you could imagine Aaron and the frustration. Now, number 16, Moses said, I want you all to go and get your incense and bring them. Well, do they remember that event or not? That's kind of scary. And Aaron, how do you think Aaron brought his incense every time he brought his incense to God? From that day forward, you can imagine Aaron's mind as he brought that incense before God. It had to be right. It had to be the way God said. Incense, of course, when you come to Psalm 141, is a symbol of prayer. Psalm 141, verse 2, David says, let my prayer be set before thee as incense. And we have lots of New Testament examples too, don't we? Revelation chapter 5 is a well-known example. Revelation chapter 5. In verse 8 it says, when they had taken the book, the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, everyone having harps and golden vials of odours or incense, which are the prayers of the saints. So in the symbol of the incense, which, you know, they made this incense out of four different types of spices. And when you entered into the holy place, and only the priests, of course, could enter into there, you were struck with the smell. That was the smell of the lamps that were burning the olive oil would strike you straight away. But then this beautiful incense, which was there before the veil, where God was dwelling behind. And as you entered into the holy place, that room would have just smelled beautiful. And that particular concoction of incense that the priests had to bring, with the four different spices. And then they had to go and get the coals that were on the brazen altar from outside, where people sacrificed their sacrifices. They took that which symbolized everybody's personal sacrifice, and that's what was used to be to as the combustion to ignite that incense. See, the litmus test of who's holy is all about your personal relationship with God. That's all that matters. We look at the outward appearance. What really matters is our relationship with God. That's the test of holiness. It's how we communicate with Him and how He communicates with us. This was the test. We will see who is holy. And so, of course, we know the story back in Numbers chapter 16. It seems that this other chap, On, the son of Pelah, he may have had second thoughts. Day two, we don't hear of him again. Maybe during that 24-hour period, he thought, no, I'm not going to go down this track. I remember what happened to Nadab and Abihu, and I'm certainly not going to put my incense up against Moses and Aaron's incense, because I know I'm going to get beaten in this competition. And I can pretty much see where this is going. So we don't hear from him anymore. Dathan and Abiram, they said, no, we do not want to come up. They didn't want to have this challenge either. But they were still prepared to try to set about what you might say was a coup against Moses and Aaron. So they stayed in their tents and gathered their congregation. Korah and his company, 250, they did appear before the congregation. They came and made their stand. And God, therefore, brought about the judgment. And of course, we know the judgment. Dathan and Abiram and all that belonged to them, they were swallowed up in the earth because they were from beneath. They were like, they tried to elevate themselves above, didn't they? But God brought them to the lowest of the low. But like the serpent, God had to pluck its wings, perhaps. Take its legs off, definitely. See, the serpent became associated with the earth. It crawled on the dust of the ground. Even an ant could lift himself off the ground with little legs. Serpent become completely related to the ground. And Korodatum or Datum and Abiram and all that they had were swallowed up in the earth because their thoughts were of the earth, earthy. And Korah and his company were consumed by fire because they made the presumption that they could bring their incense before God. And just like Nadab and Abihu, they met the same fate. Wasn't the only time that this happened, by the way, was it? If you have a look at another occasion in 2 Chronicles, in chapter 26, you'll see another man who decided that he also could bring strange fire before God. He should have read his history books. He should have known the story of Nadab and Abihu and Korah, Dathan and Abiram. But it says in verse 16 of 2 Chronicles 26, when Uzziah was strong, his heart was lifted up to his own destruction. And he transgressed against the Lord his God and went into the temple of the Lord to burn incense at the altar of incense. And what happened, of course, Azariah the priest followed him in with 85 priests and they challenged him. And in verse 19, Uzziah was wroth, and he had the censer in his hand to burn incense. And while he was wroth with the priests, leprosy even rose in his forehead before the priest and the house of the Lord beside the incense altar. He offered strange fire, and he was smitten with leprosy in that moment. In John chapter 8, Jesus faced a similar challenge from some very evil people. And I want you to see how much his reaction is like Moses' reaction. It says in verse 3 in John chapter 8 that the scribes and Pharisees brought to Jesus a woman taken in adultery and set her in the midst. And they said to Jesus, "Master, this woman was taken in the very act of adultery. Moses in the law commanded that we should stone her, but what do you say?" Verse 6, this they said, tempting that they might accuse him. They wanted to trap him, they wanted to accuse him, and they brought their case against Moses, just like Korah, Dathan and Abiram brought against Moses. They brought this case against Jesus, and look at what Jesus does. But Jesus stooped down. Jesus bowed himself down and began to write with his finger on the ground. And they continued. And then he lifted himself up, just like Moses, after he stooped down. Then he lifted himself up and said, "He that is without sin cast the first stone." And he stooped down and he wrote in the ground again. And they, which heard of it, being convicted of their sin, went out from the eldest to the youngest. Now, we haven't got time in our exhortation to develop this, but just for a moment have a look at Jeremiah chapter 17, because I think there is evidence of what Jesus wrote in the ground. This is hypothesis. I'm told you like hypothesis is here. Jeremiah 17 is known in particular for verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? But then it says in verse 13, "O Lord, the hope of Israel, all they that forsake thee shall be ashamed, and they that depart from me shall be written in the earth, for they have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters." And if you go back to John, you'll see that in John chapter 7, Jesus has only just stood up the day before and said, "If any man thirst, let him come to me. For out of his belly shall flow forth living waters." And the very next day they forsook the fountain of living waters, and they brought a woman caught in the very act of adultery to try to challenge him. And he wrote in the ground while they talked to them. And they departed from him, from the eldest to the youngest. And I believe what he wrote, supposition, is their names. From eldest to youngest, he wrote their names in the ground. Because all those that forsake me shall be written in the earth, just like Korah, Dathan and Abiram. And when you go back to John chapter 8, he challenges them over and over again to give the same test. Verse 23, he says to them, "You are from beneath. You are from the earth. Earthy. I am from above." And he talks about how the fact that God, in verse 18, bears witness of me. I bear witness of myself, but the Father also bears witness of me. It's my relationship with God which proves who I am. It's how the Father answers me which proves who I am. Jesus shows that he had pure instinct in his relationship with God. And he was holy because God answered him in all things. So the exhortation for us is a very powerful one. Because when it all boils down to it, it's our relationship with God. When you strip away everything else, what matters is our relationship with God. It's the sensor that we bring. We all must bring the sensor. You know, it'd be scary, wouldn't it? You'd think, why would I ever even want to bring a sensor? Why would I ever want to do that again? Come back to Numbers chapter 16 just for a moment. Think about this little point in conclusion. So after these events, after Dathan and Abiram are swallowed up, after Korah's, the fire comes down, then it says the next day, the very next day, the people come back to Moses and Aaron and says, "You've killed these people. You've done this." Blame game again. Didn't learn the lesson. And then it says that in verse 44, the Lord spoke to Moses and says, "Get up from this congregation because I will destroy them all in a moment." Moses said to Aaron, "Aaron, you take a censer, put fire thereon from the altar and put on it incense and go quickly to the congregation and make an atonement for them. For wrath has gone out from the Lord and the plague has begun." And Aaron took Moses' command and he ran to the midst of the congregation, and behold, the plague had begun in the people, and he put incense there and he made an atonement and he stood between the dead and the living. Do you know there was 14,700 that had already died? 14,700, that's more. That's more than what happened in the instance with Dathan and Abiram and Korah. 14,700 were dead. And in runs Aaron, and he's standing here with his incense right between them. You know, they all looked, didn't they? And the dead were dying, and then stopped. And nobody else died. Whilst Aaron held that incense. And they all looked at Aaron and they were like, "Pray, Aaron, pray." They knew what stood between them and death was Aaron and his incense. No wonder it was when Aaron died sometime later, they were devastated. Who now is going to stand for us? Who now is going to represent us before God? We're all going to die if Aaron's not here. Isaiah 53. Verse 10. "Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see the travail of his soul, and he shall be satisfied by his knowledge. Shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities? I will divide a portion with the great, and shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death. He was numbered with the transgressions, and he bare the sin of many, and he made intercession for the transgression. He stood there between the dead and the living, and he made intercession for the transgressors. And finally, Hebrews chapter 7, to conclude our picture, the difference between Aaron and Jesus. Aaron did die. And who were they going to have to stand between the dead and the living? Who were they going to have that would make intercession on their behalf? And in Hebrews chapter 7 it says, verse 23, for truly there were many priests, and because they were not suffered to continue by reason of death. So the priest couldn't continue because of mortality, but this man, because he continueth forever, has an everlasting and unchangeable priesthood, wherefore he is also able to save them to the uttermost that come to God by him, seeing he lives forever to make intercession for us. Today, tomorrow, forever. Never going to die. We have a priest which stands between the dead and the living to make intercession on our behalf. Because we know that we can never offer perfect incense to the Lord. But thanks be to God that we have a priest who intercedes on our behalf. May we never speak against that high priest.